The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ronan Farrow talked to me about investigating Hollywood's sexual assault allegations and how far some people will go to silence a story. One half of the infamous Peru 2, Michaela McCollum, spoke to me about mistakes made and lessons learned. Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton have co-authored The Book of Gutsy Women, which shines a light on histories that are often overlooked or left unwritten. And Megan Phelps Roper told me about what life was like as a member of the Westboro Baptist Church and why she chose to walk away. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy it. Ronan Farrow, a very good morning to you. Welcome to our programme.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I think what I would like to start with, Ronan, apart from your book Catch and Kill, of course, which we're going to get into the details of in a moment, is your Irishness. Because I've been watching you from afar this last 6 months going, there are very few people on pretty much every show on the US talking about your book and also your career in more recent times called Ronan. So do we have your mother or your Irish ancestry to thank for that?
You do. My grandmother, yes, on my mother's side is Maureen O'Sullivan, yes, Jane in the Tarzan movies.
Yeah, we're aware of that, from Boyle in County Roscommon.
You got it.
Right. So tell us about then that name, Ronan. Do you have any idea of why you were called that?
It is a recurring name in the family tree. And, you know, the family name is O'Sullivan. So it is indeed right there on the passport. Yeah. I've got a very over the top Irish name, Ronan O'Sullivan Farrow.
It's a proper Irish name. In fairness to you, are you a visitor to the country at all, or are you kind of a long distance admirer?
Too infrequently, mostly a long distance admirer these days. But I got to make it over there.
Okay, very much so. Well, let's get down to business. Catch and Kill is your book that I presume started out as kind of an investigation, or at least to tell us about the Weinstein and other revelations, but seemed to turn into, if I'm not mistaken, some class of espionage thriller. What class of book did you set out to write in the first instance, Ronan?
Well, you know, it is a story about the vast circles of mutual protection in politics and law and media that bury the truth, mm, and different ways that happens. And I didn't know when I started the reporting, as you alluded to, that was what I would be writing a book about. No reporter wants to be in the vice grip of those tactics, but as you alluded to, that is what happened. I found myself beset by spies hired by people I was reporting on, including, you know, undercover operatives using false identities and front companies, and the sources I was working with, in this case, very brave women who were speaking out about alleged assaults by Harvey Weinstein, were also targeted in that way. And, you know, that illustrates just how far the powerful and connected will go to squash a story.
Tell us a little bit about, if you would, the moment that you thought, you know, as a journalist, you do your research, you're kind of curious about this story, you hear rumors. When did you think, I am really onto something, and it's enormous?
So the book is about a variety of stories and kind of a trail of clues that I followed from Harvey Weinstein and his relationship with certain tabloid outlets in the States, including the National Enquirer, that buried stories for him, all the way to the relationship those same tabloid players had doing the same kind of dirty work for Donald Trump. And in the course of that reporting, you know, the sense of knowing that I had the goods happened very early. You know, you'll see when you read the book that it's basically from square one that women are on the record accusing Harvey Weinstein of rape. That I have an audio tape which was buried for years, but had been made during a police sting operation in which Harvey Weinstein admits to serial sexual, mm-hmm, assault. And that caused quite a stir when ultimately I was able to release it. But, you know, it's a good illustration of how you can have all this explosive evidence and still have these stranger-than-fiction tactics prevail in creating a veil of silence around it.
And that kind of closing circle, that it's almost suffocating. I was listening to you read your audio book version of this of your book, and you get the sense that you're kind of shadow boxing. You're trying to get out. You say, I've got all this information, you've accumulated it, you've done your research, you've checked it once, twice, thrice, and yet they keep coming at you and closing the window every time you try to get out with the story.
Yes, and I try to tell that story in the spirit of not just, you know, patting myself on the back or saying, woe is me that I encountered this kind of resistance, but to really pull back the curtain on tactics that get thrown at a whole range of reporters. And a lot of their stories run through catch and kill. You know, it's about a whole community of people who struggled to break these stories over the years. And it tries to get at the question that I was left with after I succeeded in getting some of those stories out, which was, how did it stay quiet for so long? How did high-profile, powerful people accused of terrible crimes bury those hard truths? And, you know, I think that the book, in addition to hopefully being a kind of propulsive narrative about, you know, a personal moment in my life and the lives of those sources, is a window into how that happens and a blueprint for how to stop it from happening in the future.
Well, a lot of our listeners won't be familiar with the likes of Matt Lauer, the TV presenter, who comes across as a mentor, if that's not too much to say for you.
Yeah,
at
I
one point.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about his career arc after you started telling him about the reporting you were doing and the research you were conducting.
So, yeah, you don't have to know about, you know, these particular figures, I think, for the plot and the themes in it to resonate, because this is a phenomenon, the killing of stories and the protection of powerful people, that plays out on both sides of the pond. But the specifics of this plot do involve powerful people I was reporting on, like Harvey Weinstein, this film producer in the States, and powerful people within my own network. I started this reporting at NBC News, an American television network, who had their own dark secrets. And, you know, again and again in this plot, you have this dynamic of people who are mentoring me or claiming to help me, and then turn out to be either a part of the killing of my reporting or to be part of the system that conspired to protect a lot of these powerful guys. And as you mentioned, Matt Lauer is one of the people who, you know, I start out by seeking advice from him. But by the end of the book, I'm unraveling a trail of clues about very, very dark and serious accusations against him.
You have to give of yourself quite a bit in this, Ronan. And you had to talk to you talk about regularly calling your sister Dylan. And she had her own problems, very public problems with your father, Woody Allen, in the past. And he was never charged with anything, but she very much had her accusation. And you had to bring this up again in the book. Was that a very uncomfortable experience for her, or did you feel journalistically you had no choice?
Very uncomfortable. And part of the narrative of the book is how I, for years, really struggled to outrun that very serious, very credible allegation of sexual assault raised by my sister. You know, that I think, as with many families affected by this, I just wanted it to go away. And part of the transformation I go through over the course of the plot in this book is coming to understand that I was wrong and she was right, that the times over the years where I told her, why can't you just shut up about this? Can't you just move on? I was part of a system that silences women. And, you know, ultimately, while there is no factual link between the stories I reported on and her story, there is an emotional one where I understood the stakes of this issue and what some of my sources were going through because I had seen someone close to me go through something not dissimilar.
I think it is remarkable for you to admit that, because in this country we'd have this awful situation regarding abuse, sexual abuse and so forth down through the years that we are now talking about very openly, thanks to people who are extremely brave, candid coming on programs like this and saying this is what happened, and they're being believed, thankfully. But for you to say that you turned to Dylan and say that you wanted it to go away, it is reflective, and you're a young man, so it's not like this is the 60s, 70s or 80s, but it's reflective of an absolutely inbuilt, almost systemic requirement in society to say, yeah, I know it happened, but could you just go over there and deal with it?
Yes, and I think that dynamic affects anyone raising allegations of this type.
Sure.
But it also is particularly true in the case of allegations against really powerful people who command a lot of loyalty. And, you know, standing up for my sister and saying the truth, which is, you know, as an attorney and as a lawyer and, yes, an interested party, someone who cares about her, but also someone who looked at the facts in detail, she really has a credible case and has maintained that claim over the years consistently. And there were eyewitnesses and there was evidence. Saying those things is not fun in terms of the reaction you get. You know, when it is someone who commands a lot of control of the media and has, you know, devoted fans, it means that while the backlash that I've gotten is nowhere near what she or any other survivor of sexual violence gets, I see a little bit of what makes it so hard to talk about this.
Absolutely. And again, this idea in Catch and Kill of the golden circle, if I can call it that, or at least the safe place for people like Harvey Weinstein, led you to have to tell us and write about. He essentially consulted your father, Woody Allen, for advice as you were reporting on him.
Yes.
What a bizarre sense of cosmic misfortune.
Well, part of what thrusts me into having to confront my own personal demons is that Harvey Weinstein weaponizes that past against me. Mm. You know, I'm losing my job. I'm getting these legal threat letters, and they're all about, you know, my sister and her allegation and various other things about my family that are unrelated and aren't really a convincing counterargument. But, you know, they're an attempt to hit below the belt and get me where it's most personal. So whether I liked it or not, my past was drawn into the story.
When you started to become more believed and Weinstein was outed from the shadows, what does that do for you, Ronan, at a kind of personal or intellectual level? Is it satisfaction or is it justice? Or how do you respond to all of that? And with the trial coming up in January?
You just hope that you have done your job, and you know our job as journalists is to ferret out the truth and be really fair, both to the sources who were brave and spoke, and to Harvey Weinstein or anyone else that I'm reporting on. You know, to be even-handed, and you hope that in doing this incredibly difficult thing, in risking their careers and maybe even their personal safety. You know, these women who were targeted in this international espionage operation were afraid, and rightly so. You hope that you've done right by them and that they feel like they have done something worthwhile to protect others.
All right, Ronan, it's been good to talk to you. Unfortunately, your people only gave us 15 minutes, so otherwise we'd have a lot longer to chat to you. But I wish you well with your book, and we'll talk at a greater length when you're in Ireland the next time.
I hope so. I look forward to that. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for your time. Ronan Farrow is the author of Catch and Kill, which people are enjoying. Jan in Smithfield says, loved Ronan's book, flew through it in one weekend. One of the many things I appreciated most about it was Ronan's honest reflections on how he struggled over the years with sexual abuse allegations within his own family, as he was talking to us there about that. He didn't have to include these occasional observations, but they really enriched the book for me. So congrats on an extraordinary story, well told. And that's in many ways why I thought it was very frank of him to do that, because he could have shied away from that in the book and indeed talking there. And I think it would have been probably more difficult for him if he had done that. But it took a bit of courage to do that, and it makes, as you say, Jan, the book much more enriched, is a good way of putting it. And Caroline in Cork says, I'm reading the Ronan Farrow book at the moment and it's gripping. It's an intriguing read in that I know most of the characters involved and the storyline before I started the book, but it's pulling the threads together to show me how it all connects and is connected, and it's an excellent read. Well, he certainly does write very well. He knows how to tell a story. And that book, as I say, is called Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow. At, 12 minutes to 10 o'clock. When Michaela McCollum's image was broadcast around the world in 2013, it was as one of the infamous Peru 2. She had been caught alongside another girl attempting to smuggle 11 kilos of cocaine from Lima to Madrid. She's here this morning because she wants people to know what really happened, and she hopes that by sharing her story, it might stop others from making the same mistake as her. Michaela McCollum, good morning.
Good morning.
We have so much to discuss because your book outlines your story from the beginning to the infamous photographs that we saw beamed across their televisions and the papers and so on that time, and obviously after that event. So let's begin at the beginning. You came from a big family. What mm-hmm. part of the island are you from? And tell us a bit about
from
that.
From the Republic. I'm actually born in Monaghan. So my father was from Monaghan, my mom was from Armagh. So I lived there up until I was about 5.
Lots of you?
Lots of us, the 10 of us.
Right.
Yeah, and then we moved to Auchnacloy then when I was about 5, so about 98.
Okay, and were you close to your mum and dad?
I was close to my mum. As a child I was close to my father. I think as I grew up in my teens we kind of distant a bit, but I was really close with my mum. And my brothers and sisters, we were all quite close.
What age were you when you went to Ibiza?
19.
19 years old. What was it about Ibiza at 19 for you that was an escape hatch?
Well, I had quite a few friends that had done seasons in Ibiza. And everything that I heard about it was just this beautiful island where everybody was just really happy. And, you know, it was just great. I heard these amazing things and I kind of just wanted an escape. And I thought, well, that would be the perfect escape that I can, you know, go to. You know, I can be happy there and, you know, I'll make new friends and, you know, start a new life. And I was really fortunate that I got a job and I found an apartment pretty quickly. So for the first 2 weeks, I was pretty good. I kind of worked all the time, didn't really party. Had really met many friends, and then all of a sudden it just kind of went downhill.
How?
I got introduced to a guy. We had a mutual friend, and I got introduced to this person, and that was the person that ended up getting me involved in
the big drug deal that we're going to talk about in a moment. But that wasn't. But before that, you had continued in the narcotic route that you were taking. I mean, you were doing a lot of drugs back in Ibiza.
Yeah.
What sort of drugs were you doing in Ibiza?
Mainly acid. I think that's kind of where it was like everything went wrong then, because not I'm saying that you can't have control in some drugs, but I feel like that drug you just have, you know, absolutely no control at all. Mm-hmm. But I found Ibiza, like, drugs was just such a normal thing. Like, people talked about it so normally, people sold it so normally, people, you know, consumed it like really publicly. And I was really shocked that it was like that over there, because I never really knew that before I went. And I didn't take drugs at the beginning when I went to Ibiza for the first, you know, 2 weeks, because I kind of just wanted to work. And then slowly but surely I fell into that. But
so you were derailed by what you called the Ibiza bubble.
Yeah.
Where everything is just a bit out there.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it for you to go to Peru?
This guy that had asked me to, you know, pick up this package, he had told me I was going to go to Barcelona, so he'd never mentioned Peru. So it was only until I got moved around that circle of men that I found out I was going to Peru. But they didn't even send me to Peru, they sent me to Mallorca. And then it was Peru, so it was kind of like a whole, you know, it wasn't really...
It was a roundabout route. And this guy said to you what exactly about a package?
He asked me would I go to Barcelona and pick up a package and bring it back.
And you said,
okay.
And did you know what was in the package?
No. This was in the middle of a party. I didn't even ask, like, when or what am I picking up, or I never asked anything.
And
like,
were you, because you're bright, so did you have a good idea it was probably drugs?
Yeah, I suspected it definitely was drugs, yeah.
And did he give you an offer of money in advance of this?
This guy, no.
No, but so why would you do it then?
Because at that moment of time, I kind of just thought, yeah, whatever. Like, I didn't really think anything
but
of it.
But I presume he suggested you'd be paid for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but not a specific
fee. How much, yeah.
But probably a lot of money, I suspect.
Yeah.
And did he suggest how much of the drugs you'd be...
No, he just said a package. So okay. I presumed it was just going to be something small. I know it doesn't make a difference if it's small or big, but yeah, he just said a package.
Tell me about Mallorca.
So I arrived in Mallorca and I was told that I would meet another girl there, so... When I arrived, I met this other girl from Scotland.
And then you land in Peru.
I land in Peru.
And you knew you were going to be collecting what must have been an enormous package. What were your state of mind? Were you drug-addled at that stage? Or were you calm? Or were you nervous? Or...
Well, once I arrived in Peru, I didn't really know anything about Peru. So once I arrived, I was quite startled because I didn't really know where the hell I was, or kind of like, the moment I came into the airport, I seen, you know, how many military police there was, and I just kind of had this overwhelming feeling of fear and kind of thinking, gosh, I can't do this. Like, how am I going to come through this airport with a package? So the fear kind of set in almost immediately once I arrived in Peru. But, you know, I was constantly being reassured that everything was fine, and I was kind of being overdramatic and, you know, was being really negative about the situation anytime I kind of, you know,
panicked,
addressed my concern. It was kind of like pushed aside, so I kind of thought maybe I am being a wee bit immature and, you know, dramatic. Obviously in hindsight I look back and think, no, it's totally normal to feel like that, but at that time I kind of thought, you know, I shouldn't be feeling like this. This
okay.
is normal.
So you had to wait to get to take receipt of the package.
Yeah.
And in between that arriving in Peru, you left the airport and you did touristy things with Melissa.
Yeah.
To make it look like you were just two backpackers having fun in
yeah.
Peru. You were what age? Remind me again, Michaela.
I just turned 20.
Okay. And yourself, Melissa, you went to Machu Picchu
mm-hmm.
and did the things that you do in Peru. And then you had to obviously collect the package.
Yeah.
What size was the package? If we take like a carry-on suitcase as a typical size comparison, how
probably
big was
about,
it?
Well, it filled two big suitcases. So I'd say four small carry-on cases.
Okay. And you, where did you take receipt of the cases?
So I didn't actually pick them up.
Yeah.
Melissa had picked them up outside. She met some guy and she came into the hotel and she went three times because she only had like a small bag. So she had to fill it from the boot of his car. So once she had finished and she had like laid them all out on the floor, like it was just overwhelming, because then I realised this isn't just a package, this is a really big deal. And I think that's kind of when it kind of settled into me that this was something massive. This wasn't something really small that I was thinking it was before.
And this was yourself and Melissa in one of your hotel rooms
yeah.
with the two suitcases full of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation was from the drug dealers in Peru to the guys in Ibiza to yourselves was that you were going to go through the airport with these.
Yeah.
And put them on the plane and come home, as simple as that.
Yeah.
It just sounds quite crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, in you go with your two cases. You had one each, I take it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your state of mind going through the airport doors and heading towards the luggage check-in area.
Do you know, it was just kind of like panic and nerves. Like I felt like even my voice was trembling, you know, even when I spoke, whenever we both spoke to each other, we were kind of like, you know, I think that I kind of had that feeling, like a gut feeling that I wasn't going to get on the plane. And I should have obviously listened to that feeling and thought, you know, this doesn't feel right, I shouldn't do this. So I kind of knew that, you know, this wasn't going to go through. And yeah, I went through with it anyway.
Did you take drugs that day before?
No,
you?
No, I never, since I went to my
Peru.
Work in Peru, I never.
Okay, so
anything.
Did you join a queue to check in the bags, like
yeah.
everything? Okay. And yourself, Melissa, were you beside each other? Or
yeah.
Okay, waiting for the. And at what point did you get a sense that, you know, you mentioned military earlier on. Were there sniffer dogs around? Were there men with guns?
Yeah, there was. There was a lot more security than there would be in, you know, a UK airport
sure.
or, you know, a airport here. But behind, you know, the conveyor belt, there was dogs, sniffer dogs, and there was army guards. So my suitcase passed the dog and the dog didn't react. So I kind of felt like, okay, that's one step. And then I seen my suitcase go on the conveyor belt and I kind of thought, you know, it's actually went through. But instead of going to the right where all the other cases were going, it went to the left, which was being pulled aside to kind of get inspected. But at that time, I didn't know. So this man tapped me on my shoulder and pointed to a room, you know, next door and asked me to come. So that's kind of when I thought, oh my goodness, like. So when I went into the room, they already had Melissa's case opened and instantly seen all of the bags and they knew, you know, you're not coming to Peru to take home 20 packets of porridge, like this is not, you know, and they, you know, opened it and tested it for, you know, cocaine and it came back positive and the whole room just erupted because they were so happy that, you know, they had caught, you know, such a big smuggling that morning. So instantly the room went from 5 people to, you know, like 30 people and everybody was shouting. And yeah, my anxiety, I just felt awful. And I kind of just thought, this is not happening. Like this
were you able to
happening.
Were you able to talk to Melissa at that
yeah,
point? Were you looking at each other or were you saying anything to each other?
We were standing next to each other and I was asking her, I was like, what's happening? Like, well, you know, what are we going to do? You said this wasn't going to happen. And, you know, I was panicking and she didn't speak at all. Like she just stood there and like stared at her case and she didn't speak for a good hour you know, from that happened. And, you know, I was like panicking around like a little child, being like, you know, what are you doing? Like, this, you know, why you said this wasn't going to happen? Like, look, I told you this was going to happen. And I wasn't getting any response from her. So then they checked my case and they found out that I had the same, you know, contents as Melissa. So they handcuffed us then and they brought us upstairs. So we had, I think that was the most embarrassing thing I've ever done, of having to be led out of a room while everybody's checking in, you know, and everybody was just watching us, and it was just horrific. You know, I kind of just felt like my life was over at that point.
There were people taking pictures and...
Yeah, and shouting, and everybody was staring. I couldn't even look up. I looked down the whole time, but anytime I did look up, I seen those people out with, you know, their cameras and everything, and I just thought, like, why would you video this? Like, this is not, you know, yeah, but...
Where did you end up after that incident? Because obviously you were bundled into a car and told, right, I got the sense that they were, I suppose rightly so, the police were jubilant that they had found this big consignment of drugs.
Yeah.
And so were they were in flying form, if you like, in the car with you then? You talk about that in the book, and a particular song, You Never Want to Hear Again.
Yes.
Could you give us a sense of that?
Do you know, it was the most bizarre thing ever. Like, I mean, I kind of thought, if not that I would ever imagine being arrested, but if I had have imagined being arrested, it definitely wouldn't be anything like that. So, I mean, everything about it was just strange. But we were held in the airport for over 24 hours and, you know, we hadn't ate or drank anything. So when we were being taken to a holding cell, we were all squeezed into this car. You know, me and Melissa were actually sitting on the police guard's knees because there wasn't room for us all. So it was just so unprofessional. Nobody was wearing seatbelts. We were totally overcrowded. We were so hungry, and I was begging and begging for some food because we drove past a few chicken shops. Chicken shops are massive in Peru, and they didn't speak any English, but, you know, we were like doing chicken, like back bar, because that's the only way we could communicate.
You were doing the wings with your arms?
Because I think the whole time we were there, you know, nobody understood, so it was a lot of sign language and, mimicking things to kind of get our point across. So the lady who was in the passenger seat had said, you know, we'll get you food if you'll sing a song for me. So, yeah, I sang a song in that whole state to make her happy so she would give us food. So,
What song did you sing?
Bruno Mars.
Which one?
Lazy Song.
And have you heard that since?
No, I can't even listen to him since. Like, that whole day in the airport, his music was on repeat, and it just reminds me of that time. So I wouldn't even...
What a strange thing. How many days into custody was it before you spoke to your mother?
4 days.
And tell me about that phone call.
It was really awful. I wasn't actually planning on telling my mom, because I kind of thought, like, I couldn't tell my mom I've been arrested. You know, it would just kill her. So then I'd seen that there was a missing appeal and everything on me. I seen it on Facebook that morning from the police's computer. So I kind of thought I needed to tell her to put her out of her misery. But the phone call was just awful. I called, and then my mom heard my voice, and then she started screaming. And I don't like talking about this.
I appreciate that. But can I ask you why it's so difficult to talk about her?
Because it's just emotional.
Yeah. Because you were close in many respects. And I suppose you'd become front page news around the world in some ways as well. Actually, there was no avoiding it, certainly around Europe. Had your mum been unwell then?
She kind of, when I called her, she kind of like dropped, and like she kind of fainted, and she was unconscious, and they didn't know what was wrong with her. So they were like suspecting it was a stroke, or they didn't know, but they took her to hospital and everything. And, you know, she was just overwhelmed with stress and her body just collapsed. So my brother told me that when he'd come over, but I knew my mom's voice, obviously, and I knew that I'd really hurt her. So I think that's why it's really hard, because...
You write in the book that if I could have taken my own life there and then, I'd have done it. I never felt so low.
Mm-hmm.
What had you done, do you believe, that was so low or so wrong?
Well, apart from trying to traffic the drugs, I think like the pain I inflicted on my family, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, I would never want to intentionally hurt anybody, and especially not the people close to me. So I think making my family feel the way they did was like the worst thing anybody could ever do. So
let me ask you about the prison that they took you to. I think how do you pronounce it? Virgin de Fatima?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
I mean, can you describe to me or explain to me what class of accommodation you were given at that point, Michaela?
Well, it's pretty bad. I mean, we were sharing a room with up to 100 other prisoners.
In one
cell. After a couple of months, you forget, you know, you kind of realise that you don't have any privacy. I mean, having a shower, you're having an open shower with everybody else watching you and going to the toilet, it's the same. So I think after a few months, you kind of weirdly think that's okay.
you acclimatise, yeah. I suspect. And you also had visits from strange people who what we call dark tourism in some ways. I mean, people who wanted to go and meet the Peru too. What class of people came to visit?
Do you know, there was a mix. There was a lot of Irish missionaries or people from Ireland that were in Peru visiting or doing missionary work that came to visit. And they were amazing. And then you had like another side of people that were just young people, English and Irish, on holiday and kind of thought, well, we've done all the tourist things. We thought we'll come and see, you know, yous too. So there was a mix.
And when they came to see you, did you meet them?
We met them, but we kind of just thought this is really weird. But
did they want their pictures taken with you? Did they want, you know, what do they want from you?
I don't know. Like, I can't understand why anybody would ever want to do that. But yeah, it was really, really, really bizarre. That.
What sentence were you facing at the big end of it?
So initially, I was facing 15 years.
Okay. And as you were waiting for all of this to happen, did your mother ever get across to Peru?
She came across about 6 months after I'd been arrested, but my brother and cousin had came like 2 months after.
Okay. What was that like when she arrived at the prison?
It was just amazing, and I just kind of reverted to a child, you know, like acted very childlike. I, you know, embraced her and sat on her knee and just kind of was so in love in that moment. So yeah, that was probably the best.
What did you take away from the prison experience, do you think?
A lot of things. I think I matured a lot through that time, and I kind of like, when at that moment before I went to prison, I was extremely lost. I didn't know who I was or what I wanted to be, and it just kind of helped me find myself. And yeah, it just kind of made me a better person and helped me turn my life around. You know, I didn't want to be partying all the time or taking drugs or kind of living the same kind of life that I was. So it gave me a lot of time to reflect and think, who's the person that I want to be? Because ultimately I can kind of choose who I want to be, and that person's not who I want to be. So yeah, it just really helped me focus and, you know, set goals and, you know, prepare for a future, you know, a successful future.
You described the violence and indeed the romance of the prison experience. Mm-hmm. What did you find striking about either or both of those things?
Both of them. I mean, when I moved to Ancon, that was kind of where everything was just crazy. The prison was just like, just not normal. You know, everybody was with each other. You know, there was, you know, relationships within guards or prisoners, and I just thought that was extremely extraordinary. Like, it never happened in the previous prison.
You describe a scene, in particular scene in the book, just in terms of violence, about the prison workshop. Yeah. I think it was the first day you were sewing. You were trying to sew because you said you weren't an expert in that world. What happened?
There was kind of like rivalry between different, you know, drug gangs, and there was these little, like, you know, sewing hooks, had like little hooks at the bottom that you would pull the thread through, and she just attacked another woman and, like, you know, stuck it in her neck. And
which, a needle?
Yeah,
a knitting needle,
like a little needle that had like a little hook at the top.
Oh, she stuck it in somebody else's neck.
Yeah.
And you're watching this going, this is my new life.
Yeah.
How long did you spend in prison?
2 years and 8 months, I think, in total.
And you obviously, you had to go for a hearing to be released. The judge said, what? It was music to your ears when the judge said.
When she first told me that I had been, you know, had granted my release, she was, you know, giving me my terms and conditions. I didn't really understand. Not that I didn't understand the language, because I was quite good at that time, but I just was in this daze. And then I seen everybody smiling and clapping, and then I was like, what is happening? So that just kind of felt like, I just felt, I don't know, I've never felt like that ever in my life. Just happiness and bliss.
What is that sensation like going through the prison gates when you're free?
Do you know, I still felt scared, because I kind of thought, up until the moment I came out of those gates, there were still obstacles. They were almost not going to let me go because they wanted to finish the day early. So I knew the Peruvian system, or justice system at this time, and I knew there was a chance something might happen and I might not get out. So when I was walking, it was like a long hill, probably like a 10-minute walk. I was running it because I kind of thought somebody might come behind me. So there was that fear up until that moment. But I could see my mom and my brother in the distance. And yeah, that feeling of just being free and being able just to, like, you know, walk freely without handcuffs and get into a car was just incredible.
I'm going to talk about what's happened in your life since then in a moment. But I want to just ask you about how you feel about, there are people listening to us this morning saying, that woman is a drug mule. She should not be on the radio talking to you. what she did was so wrong and so damaging in the drug, what those drugs do to communities, to children, to families. How do you answer those people who are just still so angry with you?
Yeah, well, you know, I understand firsthand of what drugs, the effect drugs can have in your life. And, you know, I unfortunately learned really harshly. You know, I learned a lesson, you know, a lot harder than, you know, most people have to learn. And obviously I take responsibility for what I've done, and I know that it was wrong. But at that time I was really stupid, and it was a really stupid, mistake to, you know, make. But everybody does make mistakes. Unfortunately, mine was a lot worse than, you know, most people in everyday lives. But I think that, you know, what happened to me and, you know, writing this book will bring a lot of awareness to drugs. And, you know, I, you know, thought I was consuming drugs innocently at 15, 16 and 17, but that led me to doing what I did.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of teenagers or young people that go down that line, yet they might not necessarily traffic drugs, but, you know, something really bad could happen. So I think it's just to bring awareness to drugs and, you know, the effects that can have.
And trace that load back to the horror that these drug dealers and drug lords are inflicting on, as I say, towns and communities, not just in Peru, but then when it comes back to Ireland, yeah, let alone Ibiza, because they'll just land back here. You know, just people don't have patience for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have time for that. And they'll see people like you and say, well, like, even there's politicians in the north who are saying, oh, Michaela McCollum's got her book out. Great. Now she's cashing in on her drug past, if you like. And why doesn't she donate the proceeds of her book, if she's that caring about it, to, you know, a drug rehabilitation charity or for children's education or so forth? How do you respond to that?
Well, do you know what? I think most people know, if I wanted to make money from this experience, I would have. You know, I had several opportunities of making money while I was in prison and several opportunities when I got out of prison.
To tell your story.
To tell my story. And, you know, I turned down a lot of money and I haven't made any money from the book. So I feel like if this was all about the money and I wanted to do that, I would have done, you know, a lot of paid interviews, which I haven't done. I think this book is mainly to bring awareness and to get my story out there opposed to money, because I think most people know you don't make a lot of money on the book. Mm. And, you know, it's not about the money. But
why did you turn down the opportunity to for big money interviews in the past?
I just had no interest. Like, I didn't, when I was getting these offers during prison, I kind of wanted to forget about it. And then when I came out, I kind of didn't want to, like, tell my story, and I wasn't really over what had happened. I'm not saying I'm over it now, but I kind of felt like that's not what I want to do. And then when I got the opportunity of doing the book, I thought this would be the perfect platform to tell my story and to help people, rather than, you know, 5 or 10 minute interviews. You know, kind of thought that would be more what I'd want to do than getting paid, you know, a lot of money for doing interviews. So
do you find your story elicits sympathy or enmity, or, you know, people dislike you or like you?
So I think there's mix, because I think there's a lot of people that, you know, can relate and think I would have probably done something stupid like that, or, you know, I've had a lot of people saying to me that, you know, at that age they have, you know, would do stupid things like that, or they've almost done things like that. So I think there's people that are like that, and then there's other people that are quite hateful towards what I did, which is okay, because what I did isn't okay. Do you know, I hold my hands up to that, but that was something I did then. So
how,
I hope.
How old are you now?
26.
Okay, and you're fluent Spanish, is that right?
Yeah.
Which is, it's like, of all the languages, I suppose. And you've met somebody along the way, important in your life, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you've had twins, is that right?
Yeah.
And tell me about them.
They're amazing. They're 18 months now. They've just brought a happiness to my life that I didn't even think existed.
What are their names?
Rafael and Rio.
And what are they bringing to your world?
Just everything. Like, I didn't think I would, you know, I never really thought I wanted to be a mother at, you know, 25. But
yeah,
Now that I have them, I could not imagine anything different. Obviously, they keep me on my toes because they are very energetic.
They would be at that, yeah, age too. And education wise, what have you achieved?
Well, once I returned from Peru, I went back to do my A-levels. So I completed my A-levels and then I went back to study Spanish in A-level because I wanted to do a degree in international Spanish. So I've just finished those qualifications and passed. So that's my next step, is to go to university and do an international business management degree in Spanish.
And put the past
behind
you.
Yeah.
Is that the dream?
That's the dream. I want to take as much positive things as I can from that experience, because that's all I can do, is kind of learn from that and try and turn it into something good. So, you know, that's kind of the goal. And
it's funny because you say, I really, really believe everything happens for a reason. Even something as stupid,
yeah,
as what you did, and as regretful as what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it has informed who you are.
Yeah.
And will do for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
Would you change everything if you could?
Do you know, if I changed that, I wouldn't have my children now. And I couldn't possibly say I changed that because it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. But obviously I wish that that never happened. I wish things didn't have to go that way. But yeah, if I could have done things differently, I definitely would have.
Well, Michaela, thank you for coming in to see us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Michaela McCollum is the author of You'll Never See Daylight Again, My Prison Journey as One of the Infamous Peru Two. The text number is always 51551. Okay, well, let me introduce my guests this morning. Have written a number of books on their own, but have come together to write the Book of Gutsy Women, Favourite Stories of Courage and Resilience. What a pleasure it is to welcome Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton. Nice to talk to you both, and thanks for joining us on the programme.
Oh, it's great to talk with you again, Ryan.
What is the definition of gutsy in 2019?
We see gutsy as a description of women who live their lives with purpose and determination, often overcoming odds and obstacles, trying to make a positive difference in the world, as well as achieving their own hopes and dreams. And for us both, these stories are inspirational because the women themselves are not perfect. There is no such thing. Mm. And we talk about, a lot of the trauma and tragedy that affected a number of the women in the book. But they are courageous. They are resilient. And as we began talking about them in writing this book, we kept coming back to the word, they're just gutsy. Mm-hmm. And we have gutsy women. Every one of your listeners has gutsy women in their lives.
It's or so maybe true. They themselves are a gutsy woman.
Absolutely.
Yes. So we're talking in the realm of compliment in extremis,
yes,
here, obviously.
Hugely, hugely complimentary.
Because the language around complimenting, be it male or female, particularly women, when you, in once upon a time, you'd call a gutsy woman might have been feisty or fiery. And that became unacceptable because it was considered a little bit genderized, if that's the right word.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And is that right?
Well, I think you're pointing out something that is very important to both of us, and that is the way women's voices and their lives have been written out of history because they didn't fit some pre-existing stereotype of how a woman is supposed to behave and look. And so when we use words like feisty and fiery, we do mean them as compliments, but we often see in the press and even in just everyday language,
yes,
people who use words like that to dismiss a woman, to kind of put her beyond the pale. Mm. She's too feisty, she's too aggressive, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, you're right that the way language is used ever since literally the beginning of recorded time, going all the way back to the Odyssey, to silence women is something we were really conscious of as we were writing this book. And we chose that word gutsy deliberately.
We have about three things in common, probably. One is that we like real books for the most part. And two, if not the three, but two certainly is we are all, the three of us, parents of daughters. And with that in mind, a book like this, I suspect, is as much, as I sometimes refer to books like this, as much a manual as it is a lesson in the past.
Absolutely, Ryan. And one of kind of the conversations that my mom and I have had for so long that really informed kind of this effort is that we don't want to write out kind of the men kind of who we learned about in school, kind of in the history books, but we very much want to write in the women, because we do owe an enormous debt to not only the 103 women that we write about in this book, but to countless others, including kind of in our own lives, who have helped kind of push forward what is possible and kind of what kind of the next generation can imagine and then do. Mm. And for me, as the mother of both a daughter and sons, I want all three of my children to at least understand why I admire these women so much. And I want my sons to have kind of strong, gutsy women role models because I think it is really important that our sons look up to women as well as for our girls to have galvanizing, inspiring women that they kind of draw inspiration from.
Of course. And as a program that we have here, we talk about history a lot. And it becomes increasingly apparent as we study history, as we acknowledge broader aspects of history, that the shadows of history are populated by unacknowledged women.
Yes. And in the introduction to the book, we have a story that Chelsea and I both read and immediately sent to the other. We do that a lot. We read something and then we, you know, forward it so that the other can read. And we read this story about scientists discovering a skeleton in a monastery and about 1,000 years old. And they were examining it and they found in the teeth fragments of blue stain. Mm-hmm. And they were confused because the skeleton was clearly that of a woman, but the only other teeth that they had ever found in that way of having blue stains were all men, because it was common for the artists, oftentimes religious people who were illuminating texts, including the Bible, to be using different colors. And one of the most precious colors, the color blue, came from lapis lazuli, the stone, and it would be crushed and then it would be mixed with water. And oftentimes the artist would lick the brush. So the conclusion inevitably had to be that this woman was also a highly regarded artist, being allowed to use this very expensive, rare pigment. Mm-hmm. And it just really resonated with us, because mm-hmm. if we could go back in time, I used to think that heaven would be like sitting in a giant movie theater with a remote control, and you could say, I want to go back to, you know, the dinosaurs, or I want to go back to the Renaissance, wherever you wanted to go, yeah. and you could see it all unfold. If we could turn the clock back and had the ability to see, we would see women doing so many different things. And that's what Chelsea and I mean when we talk about writing women into history.
Some of the names that, I mean, people will be familiar with from your book include, you know, Anne Frank, obviously, Billie Jean King, Rosa Parks, Maya Angelou, Ellen DeGeneres is in there, Marie Curie and Hedy Lamarr and the like. But I'd like to alight on a couple that would certainly resonate with our listeners this morning, because Anne Sullivan was very much involved in the life and times of Helen Keller. She makes the book, obviously, because she had an impact on not only both of you, no doubt, but just globally, a massive impact.
Oh, absolutely, Ryan. I mean, for us, Helen Keller is such a kind of singular American woman person, not only because of kind of her determination to learn, kind of made possible by Anne Sullivan, that she learned to communicate after she'd been written off by mm-hmm. all but her own family. But then she used her story to fight for first Americans and then kind of everyone globally who similarly were disabled to kind of fight for their equal right to an education. Yes. She went on to be one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, to then fight more broadly for kind of civil rights and opportunities. She traveled the world kind of arguing for peace and trying to help kind of heal after the First World War, and particularly like all of the divisions that were far too common then and have echoes today. So, you know, when you were kind of talking about kind of the stories that still have resonance, you know, we think we have so much to learn from Helen Keller's personal story of just gutsiness and persistence, but also kind of her optimism that she just believed she could make a positive difference every day in the lives of people with disabilities and really in the lives of everyone.
But I think your point yep. is really important. You know, every one of these women had somebody to help them along the way, maybe not as dramatically as Anne Sullivan transformed the life of Helen Keller, but all of them had somebody who said, get back up, keep going. And the thing about Anne Sullivan, which we say in the book, is that she helped Helen Keller go through Radcliffe College. And Helen Keller became the first woman with a disability to get a degree from such a prestigious higher education institution.
And she was the first person with deaf blindness mm-hmm. to get any college degree right. in the United mm-hmm. States.
But we say Anne Sullivan should have gotten a degree right alongside her. And in fact, in the book, we yes. say it's not too late for Radcliffe to posthumously
yeah.
recognize her, yeah. because the only way Helen Keller could have been successful at Radcliffe was Anne Sullivan sitting there working with her hour after hour. So a lot of the unsung gutsy women, the heroines that are oftentimes at the side or, you know, standing just a little bit off from the center stage, are just as important to remember. And so I'm still hoping that Radcliffe remedies
that
wrong
fix
and
that.
Anne Sullivan gets that degree.
I hear, hear on that one. but Chelsea Clinton, you're sitting beside your mother, Hillary, now, and arguably for a lot of people, she would be one of the most gutsy people in modern times. What do you look at her and see in terms of the gutsy index?
Well, I think she's off the charts on the gutsy index, Ryan.
And what would you consider to be the most gutsy thing she's done in her life, as you see it?
Oh, probably get up the day after the 2016 election and just keep going. Because she didn't feel then or now, and I'm sitting next to her so she can talk for herself, but I know that she didn't feel then or now that her work was finished. And so I am so proud of her kind of life of gutsiness, because her gutsiness just continues and continues to inspire me. And I know so many others, because people come up and tell me every day that they're inspired by her.
I'm curious to think about that morning, as you say it, Hillary Clinton, about this idea of you waking up. Which did you want most, a coffee, a hug, or a new job?
Wow, all three. You know, it was tempting just to pull the covers back over my head and not get up, to be honest. You know, it is obviously hard to lose anything that you care deeply about. And I thought I'd be a really good president and still do. But you have to take stock of where you are and what you want to continue doing. So for me, it was writing a book, what happened about that election, trying to make sense of it. And to sound some alarms, Ryan, because there's clearly an effort underway to undermine and disrupt democracies. You and Ireland are right in the middle of it as you see this ongoing strife over Brexit, to leave or not to leave. And unfortunately, the current government of the UK is not releasing a report that its own government did about Russian influence, probably in the Brexit vote, but maybe, you know, far beyond that. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I am someone who has an opportunity to be heard to sound the alarm, because there's a big move toward authoritarianism and many parts of the world right now, and we have to hold the line. We cannot take our democracy for granted, and I'm hoping that in some way I can continue to speak out and take a stand that will inspire others to do the same.
Do you think that your own country has the feel of an authoritarian leadership?
I think we have a wannabe authoritarian as our president. There's no doubt about that. He admires dictators. He speaks fondly of them. We don't really know the full extent of his dealings with them, because unlike other presidents, he is not at all transparent. There is no record of the calls that he makes. There are many more than the one that is currently the subject of an investigation. He apparently, you know, talks quite often to people like Putin. And it is troubling because of his own predilection, his own admiration for people who are strong men leaders, but also because of the continuing interference of Russian intelligence operatives in our own election system. So, yes, I think that we were in some ways the great big canary in the mine because of what happened to us in 2016. But it is continuing to happen. I mean, why wouldn't it? The Russians feel like they were successful, and their combined efforts, along with failures by our big tech companies, particularly Facebook and other allies of this movement away from democracy and progressive politics to forces controlling the economy and society again, should, I think, raise big red flags everywhere.
And Donald Trump mentions you quite a lot, Hillary, and yeah, you're both agreeing on that. And I'm just curious as to why, given that it was 3 years ago, that he doesn't seem to have got over the fact that, you know, that you and he have, while you had your beef, that maybe it was time for him to move on a bit. But what's happening there?
Ryan, I think he knows that he is an illegitimate president, that he sought and received help from outside forces, that the combination of the tactics that were used in that election was really the reason why the outcome was as it turned out. So I think he lives with that reality. He's a guy who is a fabulist. He creates his reality the best that he possibly can, and, you know, uses a lot of delusionary language, alternative facts to obliterate what we see right before our eyes. But he knows. He knows what happened. I think we know more, but not all, of what happened. And even his own government has been issuing warnings on a regular basis for the last 2 years that the Russians are still in our election system, that there are threats to our electoral process, that we can't, you know, rest. We have all kinds of weaknesses in how we conduct our election that have been and will again be exploited. So I think he can't. He can't get rid of me because it hangs like a big dark cloud over his own legitimacy.
Ryan,
I just also want to say, because I think it's not only topical given we're here talking about the book of Gutsy Women, but it would be, I would feel sort of insincere if I didn't raise it. I also think it's because my mom's a woman, and he just can't believe that she went toe to toe with him and won, you know, 3 million more votes than he did in our kind of popular vote count. So I do think kind of that's part of his ongoing obsession with her. As she says, you know, she lives rent-free in his head, and I think it is partly because she is a she.
But do you think he sleeps at night knowing, among other things, that he won the Electoral College, and therefore, as far as he's concerned, it was a win for democracy in the great American story?
I wish that he were focused on democracy and the great American story, Ryan, and I don't believe either of those things to be true.
Let me ask you, you did something very interesting, Chelsea, not too long ago. I mentioned it on this program, which was you defended Donald Trump's son, Barron, in terms of media comment and intrusion and so forth. I thought that was a kind thing to do for somebody who probably won't be first in the queue at the Trump Christmas party.
Well, I don't think I'm even invited to the Trump Christmas party.
Really?
At least if
is there one? I
don't know, but I certainly haven't
got lost in the
I haven't been invited yet. Yet.
But you know
There's
where I'm coming
time.
From, obviously.
No,
yeah.
I do,
yeah.
But I actually feel very strongly about this, Ryan. I mean, I feel very strongly that every child everywhere deserves to have a childhood, including those who live in the White House. And I think that Barron Trump has been subjected to just merciless teasing and derision and insult from adults who should know better. And I will continue to defend his right to privacy and his right to his own childhood and agency to kind of tell his own story whenever he may want to do that, instead of others, you know, imposing how they feel about his father onto him, because that is not his water to carry. And I do clearly have just intense feelings about this, not only because of my own experience, but because I do wish that even if kind of we couldn't agree on anything, we could at least agree that kind of children should be left out of our political debates.
How do you reflect on your time in the White House, Chelsea, as a child? I mean, was it a fascinating museum, or was it a gilded cage?
Well, I thankfully never felt like I was in a cage. I mean, even before we were literally caging children in our country, which is, to me, among the most shameful things this administration has done. I was always aware, Ryan, that I kind of lived in the White House. I mean, I came home from school or ballet, our friends and I walked into the diplomatic receiving room. I mean, that was the name of the room that I kind of first walked into. So I never forgot that I kind of was living among history and that I felt a real responsibility to be a proud part of that history. And yet I also very much kind of knew it as my home. I mean, my mom ensured that I had to make my bed, that no one was going to do that for me, and that I had chores, but also that I could have friends over and my friends' families over for, you know, movie nights or dinners, Christmas parties, Ryan. We invited all of my friends and their families to our Christmas party. And so it was both like an extraordinary bit of history that I called home and also still very much my home.
Fascinating. And all this week, we're looking at impeachment stories in Washington, D.C. And Hillary, I'd like to ask you, as somebody who lived through an impeachment inquiry and so forth in different circumstances, would you have a little sympathy for Melania Trump, for example, this week?
Well, I have this rather unique experience, Ryan, because in 1974, I was a young lawyer on the staff of the impeachment committee that investigated President Nixon.
Sure.
So I know what it means to undertake this really solemn effort and do it in the right way, in a way that accords with the facts, the law, and the Constitution.
Yeah.
And as you say, I lived through another where none of that was really foremost. It was unfortunate that it played out that way. But now I see the Democrats in the House doing their job again in a very thoughtful, fact-driven way. And I think I would echo what Chelsea said. I don't think the family members who are not involved in the day-to-day work of the White House, and there are some who, as you know, are, or who have, you know, no political role, really, should not be dragged into it. I think if people, whether they are part of a president's family or his staff or his supporters, engage in behavior that is law-breaking, then they should be held accountable.
At the last time, we're finishing up now in our interview this morning, Hillary and Chelsea Clinton. The last time I think we met Hillary was first was in Chappaqua, beside your home there in upstate New York. And the second time was in Dublin. Both times you said to me, but they were both after the election. And both times you said that one of the greatest things that ever happened, waking up the day after that race we talked about earlier on, was that your grandchildren would now be a much more important, or at least they would feature more in your life. Were you good to your word in that, if you like, familial electoral promise, or have you broken it on occasion?
I have tried my utmost to fulfill it in the most generous way, Ryan, because I'm so lucky that I live close enough to my daughter and her family that I can come and go pretty much at will. As we speak, my husband is attending Grandparents' Day with the two older children at their preschool. So we try to stay very much involved, and we love every minute of it, even though I have to confess, it's exhausting. It was hard taking care of one. Taking care of two was like triple the challenge, and now we've got three.
Yes, so, Jasper, congratulations, like I said.
Yeah, I'm upping my workout so that I can keep up with them.
I'm just thinking of it. Like, if you're going to have a grandmother, grandfather day, you might as well have Bill or Hillary Clinton rocking up to the school. That's going to change. I can't let this moment go, by the way, without asking you who's going to be the next president of America.
Well, someone other than the current occupant. That is my hope and my prediction.
And you're not going to give us a name this morning, obviously. But
no, because we don't know. We're still in the process of sorting it all out.
Of course you are. But you live in hope. Do you think do you fear disappointment in that regard?
I think it's going to be very tough. I don't want to sugarcoat it. And I've told every one of the candidates who has reached out to me, they have tried to rig the system in such a way that they suppress votes and voters even coming out to vote, and they use, you know, all kinds of techniques to just drive propaganda at people through primarily Facebook. So, you know, they have more money than they know what to do with, and they're going to spend it all to try to keep Trump in office. So we have our work cut out for us. But I think at the end of the day, the American public is going to say, wait a minute, we can't let this keep going.
Okay, well, look, it's been great to talk to you both. I don't know what your... have you got a book of the year so far, Hilary? Is there anything... I mean, we're heading towards the end of 2019. Anything jumping out at you this year?
The Overstory.
The Overstory?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to make a note of that. That's good to know that. And anything else we should be reading, by all means. And I'll trade you one from our end, which is Shadow Play by Joseph O'Connor. So make sure you write that down. I think
we got it.
You got it? Good for you both. Listen, thank you for your time and congratulations on the book of Gutsy Women. It's certainly a book that will find very welcome homes in bookshelves around this country, no doubt about it. And it's been great to talk to you both this morning. Wish you well in all you do. Hilary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea, a very good morning to you both.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Text number, as always, 51551. Megan Phelps Roper grew up as a member of the Westboro Baptist Church, the hate group her grandfather founded in Kansas. Fully indoctrinated with the group's fervent homophobia, anti-Semitism and extremist agenda, Megan was protesting at age 5 and later spoke for the church on social media. But by opening Twitter dialogues with people outside Westboro, Megan began to question her beliefs. And she joins us now as an activist and author to talk about her memoir On Follow, which documents her account of a remarkable personal transformation. Megan, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, would you kind of describe to the uninitiated, and I mean that metaphorically, obviously, what the Westboro Baptist Church was, is, and what it represents?
The church is a very small organization started by my grandfather and consisting almost entirely of his children, grandchildren, and now great-grandchildren. I was one of those grandchildren. There's only about 80 people total in the church. And we started protesting when I was 5 years old, 1991. Started at a local park and then, you know, very quickly morphed into this campaign against everyone outside of Westboro. We believed that everyone outside of the church was evil and hell-bound, and that it was our duty to go and warn them that if they didn't change their ways, then God would curse them in this life and then send them to hell in the next. So for us, it was a very clear, you know, black and white situation.
It was all kind of started by your grandfather, the late Fred Phelps. Is that right?
Exactly.
And how would you characterize him as a person? Tell us about him.
Well, I mean, to me, he was my grandfather. He was, you know, loving and doting and very sweet, but he also was this fire and brimstone preacher. He had spent, you know, decades in the 60s and 70s and 80s fighting for civil rights in the state of Kansas. He was a civil rights pioneer, you know, got awards from groups like the NAACP. And then, you know, after, you know, the late 80s, he was disbarred. And then this campaign against the LGBTQ community began. And with the same fervor that he fought for civil rights for blacks, he fought against gay rights. And because he saw that as it was a scriptural position for him, the Bible controlled everything. That was what motivated his civil rights work for blacks and then also this anti-gay campaign.
What were the more bizarre places you found yourself outside holding a placard?
I mean, outside of my own high school was, I mean, maybe one of the, my own high school graduation, my own, you know, those were, I think, that felt the most bizarre because it was this, you know, we had always kind of maintained this separation between, you know, who we were at school and who we were on the picket line. There was kind of this compartmentalization. But, you know, other than, you know, my own personal experience there, we protested. You know, religious, you know, organizations, you know, other churches, synagogues, mosques eventually, but just anywhere where people gathered. So outside of, you know, sporting events and concerts and eventually soldiers' funerals became a target. And that was the, you know, when I was about 19 years old, that was when we started protesting soldiers' funerals. And the logic there was that this dead soldier is clearly a curse from God and not a blessing, and it is because of the sinfulness of America. So there was always, from the outside, I think people would see a lot of what we did as bizarre, but there was always this internal logic, and there was always Bible verses to be quoted to explain why we had to take each bizarre step that we took.
Well, let's tiptoe back then to your earlier childhood, Megan, if I may, and talk a little bit about you as a child going to a regular school and yet then going home to the church. How did you marry the two worlds in your young head?
I really separated them. You know, sure. I started kindergarten a few months after we started protesting. So the picketing came first. And the people that I went to school with, these were people who we all knew what I did outside of school. And like I said, the compartmentalization was absolutely essential for all of us, for me and for them and for our teachers. You know, I think people saw us in school. My family raised us to be polite, to be good students, to be helpful. And so I think it was hard for people to reconcile the people we were in the classroom with the people we were on the picket line, which, you know, we would be out there, you know, singing praises, for instance, to the homemade bombs that were killing American soldiers. We were, standing on the American flag. You know, occasionally we burned the American flag. And it just, for me, I just understood the way that I married them was to, you know, I understood that my family, I believed that they were good people, and that the rest of the world was all either evil or delusional. God had just blinded them and had given us this truth. And oh, how lucky I was to be part of this organization that God himself was leading.
I recall watching, obviously your world came to me through Louis Theroux, who did, I think he's made three programs about the church and beyond. And what always struck me, Megan, was the ferocity of the language used, be it on the placards or the chanting, about fag enablers, quote unquote. It was really, really visceral and really, really angry. There was a lack of, to me, compassion, love, things that you would have hoped the Bible would be preaching to people. Does that make sense as a point?
Yeah. I mean, so this is something, there was a passage in the book of Jude that says, you know, of some have compassion and others save with fear. So the compassion part was kind of reserved for us, for people within the church, and people outside were basically all considered as, you know, they were deliberately doing things that they knew were wrong, and so they got the fear part of it. They got the hard lines and harsh tones that you saw on the picket line. We just believed that, you know, it was essential for us to be out there. Very plainly, you know, one of the earliest verses I memorized as a kid was this passage from the book of Isaiah that says, "Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgressions." So we had to be out there very plain spoken, saying these things. And we saw that as a loving thing, even though obviously people didn't experience it that way.
You were in the crowded hallway of your high school when you heard about how an airplane had hit the World Trade Center. Obviously, I'm talking about 9/11. And your reaction was?
I said, you know, my instinctive response was to say, "Awesome." I thought it was a punishment from God. It was the condign wrath of God. That was how my grandfather put it. Anytime anything bad happened, you know, I was raised in a culture that celebrated tragedy and death as again the divine punishment from God, and that we had a duty to thank God for everything because it was by definition good and righteous.
And you went to Ground Zero, did you, with the protest?
We went to, I wasn't actually there. I protested, I think it was about a year or so after 9/11. And we protested the New York Fire Department and, you know, said that the people who had died were in hell. Thank God for September 11. We went actually 10 years later at the, you know, dedication. There was a big memorial service. And during the moment of silence, we sang "Happy Birthday, September 11. And this is something that I came to, you know, once my faith started to unravel, my belief in Westboro's doctrines, I started to encounter these Bible passages that made me rethink a lot of what we had done. Mm. including this passage where the Apostle Paul says, "To the weak I became as weak, that I might gain the weak." And I felt so ashamed and full of regret at what we had done. You know, we had all these Bible verses to justify why we did what we did. But, you know, I was coming to realize that there were a lot of other Bible verses that absolutely should have caused us to consider the effect that we were having on these people. We had learned to completely, you know, to be filled with disdain for them and for their feelings, and to not take those things into account. And it was absolutely devastating to realize, you know, the full effect and the magnitude of the cruelty of what we had done.
As a kind of sidebar, Megan, to our conversation, as you described the Bible and how it led you to such hate, it can lead others to such love. And I'm not just talking about the Bible, I'm thinking about the Quran. And many of the great religious works of all time can be interpreted, can't they, by zealots who want to bring the world in one direction, and other types of people who want to bring them another way. They can be troubling manuals sometimes.
Yeah, and I would say that I think both, that, like, there is some truth. In other words, I think that there are absolutely things in the Bible, like those verses that we memorize. We didn't make up those verses. You know, they really are there, and there are people. You know, so there's sometimes there's this idea that, you know, people don't derive their values from their religion. They bring their values to their religion. So if you only take away hateful things from the Bible if you are already inherently hateful. I don't actually believe that. I think that there are absolutely a lot of things in the Bible that lead people, if you believe that it is the divine word of God, can lead you to really destructive places. But there are also, like you said, some really beautiful things in the Bible. I gave a TED Talk a couple of years ago that was essentially about how to engage with people you disagree with. I realized when I got to the end of it that at the root of all of that was Jesus' command to love your enemies. There is a lot of really wonderful things, and I think a lot of destructive things in these texts, and finding ways of navigating that is not such an easy thing.
No, and indeed that your TED Talk has over 8 million hits, so people are agreeing with that sentiment rather than previous sentiments discussed thus far in relation to your book. Mm-hmm. Let's continue a bit to 2009, when your church, the Westbury, were preparing for the end of the world. And your grandfather kind of lost whatever reason he had left, really, didn't he, with the election of Barack Obama. Tell me about what was happening there.
Yeah, he believed that Barack Obama was the Antichrist. And there was a lot of, you know, the church started to kind of, as you say, kind of go off the deep end. They were trying to interpret the book of Revelation to apply to today. And it led to some kind of strange theology that I had a hard time following. Just as always, I had assumed that the problem was with me. Anytime I had a question or a doubt or a feeling against Westboro's ideology, I assumed that the problem was with me, that I just wasn't spiritual enough to understand. But also in 2009, that was the point at which, you know, that theology, that new theology, brought us to protesting and focusing our attention a lot on the Jewish community. And that was the point at which I got on Twitter. And that was, you know, I started targeting Jewish people. And that ended up being a huge part of my change of heart and mind.
And it's curious because Twitter appears to have offered you, a bit like the Secret Garden, you were looking through the gate and seeing possibilities beyond the church. And something seemed to happen there in terms of you going from diatribe and monologue and increasingly tiptoeing towards dialogue.
Absolutely. And I think it has so much to do with the way that certain people on Twitter responded to me. Part of it was the platform itself. So when I joined Twitter, it was this total monologue. I was just talking at people. That was how I had learned to speak. We would say things like, "We have nothing to learn from these people. These people have nothing to offer us." So that's how we saw outsiders. So even though I went to public school and was exposed to people all the time, I always kept them at arm's length, and I knew that they were evil and that I couldn't trust them. on Twitter, having this physical distance, you know, from people, it kind of allowed me to be vulnerable in a way that I never had been in physical space with other people. And so we start, you know, I start saying all the things that the very provocative, using the same kind of provocative language we used on the picket line and on our signs, and also the kind of casual insults that my family tossed around, you know, frequently. And I realized pretty quickly that, you know, on Twitter, you have this immediate feedback loop where I would, you know, put those insults in there and then the conversation would immediately derail and we're no longer talking about these, you know, important doctrines. We're now talking, you know, this, it just becomes this kind of playground quarrel is what it seemed like. So I stopped using those insults. I started to kind of instinctively, and it wasn't a deliberate attempt to soften the language. It was an attempt to convey our message in a way that people could actually hear what we were saying. But there was this also this group of people there who started to become like friends to me. So amidst this deluge of hostility, which I had absolutely come to expect on the picket line, you know, I still experienced a lot of that on Twitter. People, you know, sending rape threats and death threats and telling me to die in a fire and all kinds of, you know, just everything that you would, you know, the worst kinds of things that we still see on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But there was also these people who recognized in my words that I was sincere, that I really believed that what we were doing was the right thing. And so they started challenging me, you know, very gently and kindly and compassionately. It wasn't that they, you know, they never, I wouldn't say they like, you know, pulled any punches or anything. It was, but they would ask me hard questions, but it was, I could tell from the way that they spoke to me that they actually cared about me and were, and wanted good things for me. And this became a kind of alternative form of community for me, which Westboro had been my only, you know, source of community before then. And over time, you know, experiencing, for instance, this disconnect between, you know, when something tragic would happen, you know, there would be some news about a famine in Somalia, or, you know, when, you know, that terrible terrorist attack happened in Norway in 2011, and all those children were murdered. Mm-hmm. That when I would experience this disconnect between the way that my family at Westboro responded, the way that I had learned to respond, and this new way that I was responding now, like seeing the way that people on Twitter were, you know, the anguish that they felt and the grief. And
your family was kind of triumphant, a bit like your post 9/11 awesome comment. They would have been delighted.
Absolutely.
The wrath of God mm-hmm. has come down on Norway or wherever there's whatever given tragedy there was in a particular month and so on. And you had this strange fork in the road emotionally.
Yes. I mean, and triumphant is absolutely the perfect word for the way that my family, you know, responded. They would, you know, watch the body count, you know, rising with glee. And it took time, not that much time, ultimately. I would say it was about, you know, over the course of about a year or so that I started to realize that I was feeling differently about these things that were happening and kind of looking to the Bible to, you know, for examples of people in the Bible mourning when bad things happened. And in other words, just having this alternative community was a huge, huge part of that fork in the road. And there did come a day when I eventually, the questions and the doubts that I was having, this disconnect between how I was feeling and how the church was, where I realized we might be wrong.
Sure, and that brings us to this extraordinarily important year in your life, 2012. And you were 26 years old, and I'm just kind of going through it a little bit in the sense that you were kind of tired of being treated like a child. You'd got a little insight into how the real world worked. And you and your sister essentially decided it's time to get out of here. And you did get out eventually after one failed attempt. But in October 2012, out you go. And I get the impression that although it was difficult for your family, it wasn't as tempestuous is probably the wrong word, but it certainly wasn't quite as horrific an ordeal in the physicality of escape as one might have expected.
Right, yeah. I mean, this is one way. There are aspects of Westboro that are kind of cult-like, but this is one way where it isn't.
Sure.
Westboro does not want you there if you don't want to be there.
Okay.
So, you know, my parents, they helped us pack the day that we left. And you know, they, it wasn't a, it, there, there's no attempt to force you to stay or to, you know, they'll try to convince you, but if you won't be convinced, then, you know, they want you to leave.
And out you went. What was it like leaving a compound of the heart and a compound of the body?
It was terrifying. You know, there was 4 months before I left, you know, from the moment that it first occurred to me that we might be wrong. And that was when everything kind of fell apart. Those 4 months were absolutely devastating. But I realized after I left the church that it was far worse contemplating leaving, you know, being among this group of people that I loved and cared about so much. And, you know, the prospect of losing them and of, because it's not just, you know, leaving the church, it isn't just like you stop going to church on Sunday. It's you are completely excommunicated by everyone you've ever loved. This worldview that had been, you know, just everything, you know, this ministry that had been my entire life, my life organized around it and promoting Westboro's message, my lifelong home, my job. So everything that had ever been important to me was suddenly, you know, going to be gone. And the prospect of losing it was actually, you know, once I came to terms with it, once I understood that it was the right thing to do and went through with it, there was a sense of relief and liberation after I left that I hadn't expected. Hadn't expected it to be easier than the prospect of it.
You said of your family, losing them was the price of honesty, a shredded heart for a quiet conscience. Was it a price worth paying, Megan?
I think it was. There was never, once I came to that, the realization that we were doing things that were unnecessarily cruel and hurtful to other people, that there was no way that I could continue doing it. There was a very, very brief moment when it first occurred to me that I might have to leave, that maybe, like, could I continue, could I pretend just so I could keep my family? And, you know, the answer was immediately came back, no. And this is something that, you know, a friend after I left the church said, you know, in a way, he said, you are your parents' children. In a way, leaving Westboro Baptist Church was the most Westboro Baptist Church thing you could have done, because they're the ones who's taught you to stand up for what you believe in, no matter what it costs you. And that's absolutely, I think, the value that they place on truth and honesty and forthrightness. I absolutely still carry that today.
I'd like to end our conversation, Megan, which I've thoroughly enjoyed, and thank you for your candor. But I would like to end our conversation by asking you about the power of the game Words with Friends and what it brought to your life and how you are today in 2019. And you're smiling, and I'm glad to hear that. But tell me about that. Words with Friends and Megan Phillips Roper.
One of the people that I encountered on Twitter bragged about his Words with Friends prowess, and I impulsively responded with my username and a hashtag. And so these conversations that began on Twitter continued on Words with Friends. And over time, I completely fell in love with this anonymous stranger. And eventually, after I left the church, I met him, and we got married 3 years ago, and now we have a one-year-old daughter who's back at our hotel this morning, and I am just incredibly grateful that platform exists.
You have the whole world ahead of you, Megan. It's been a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Congratulations on your book and indeed on your family, your new family, and we wish you well in what you do. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Megan Phelps Roper is the author of Unfollow. And Louise Theroux actually describes it as a book for people, a companion piece nearly for the people who liked Hillbilly Elegy and Educated, both of which we've featured on this programme. But Unfollow, with its nice Twitter-esque reference there, is the book A Journey from Hatred to Hope. And that's, as I say, by Megan Phelps Roper. The text number this morning, 51551.